Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Grapevine Open Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Gail, and I'm an alcoholic. I'll be your host for the month of May. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. You can enjoy the Grapevine Open Meeting every Wednesday at noon Eastern Time on this virtual platform. The meeting will be recorded and will be posted as an audio podcast every Friday on all podcast platforms on aagrapevine.org and on YouTube. This is an open meeting. Everyone is welcome. We are glad you are all here, especially newcomers. If you are new to AA and want to learn more about our program of recovery from alcoholism, we encourage you to find an AA group in your area. Contact with group members will help you to find a sponsor and help you learn about the AA program of recovery from alcoholism. And today's Grapevine quote, which is very succinct, May the 6th, 2026, happiness is not a station we arrive at, it's a way of traveling. And that's from May 1953. You can sign up to receive the daily quote as a daily email at aagrapevine.org, or you will find it on the AA Grapevine app every morning. And here's an excerpt from this month's Grapevine magazine. It's an article called What Works for Me. A member takes a keener look at how we help alcoholics and what our primary purpose actually is. Tradition 5. Each group has but one primary purpose: to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And the excerpt is, Tradition 5 doesn't give me the right or the responsibility to try to persuade another alcoholic to stay in AA. I don't actually know what's best for anyone else. How freeing is this? And then a short reading from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's on page 66, part of How It Works. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way this disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful at all to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. This is a two-speaker meeting. There will be no sharing by attendees. So please sit back, relax, and listen. We often hear it best to try and identify with the speaker rather than compare your story with theirs. I would like to first introduce my first speaker today, and it's Trish L. from Vancouver. Welcome, Trish.
Thank you so much, Gail. And thank you for the incredible privilege of sharing with all of you today and for the loving invitation. And big thanks to Grapevine for just everything Grapevine. My name is Trish and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is February 19th, 1994. My home group is the Chris and Pates Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in White Rock, British Columbia, which is about 40 minutes outside the big city of Vancouver. I sobered up in Vancouver. That's where my first home group was. I was a member of that home group for 29 years. So when I moved to White Rock, it was a bit of an adjustment for me to try and find a new home group. But nonetheless, the lessons I learned in my first home group have stayed with me, and I hope are carrying into White Rock. It's I have to say, 29 years with the same home group, it was wonderful for me. It was absolutely wonderful for me because I firmly believe, what I was like, oh my God, I was such a typical alcoholic. I was from the get-go. I firmly believe in the kind of genetic predisposition to alcoholism. I certainly all over my family. And there's one thing I like to do when I'm given the opportunity to share, and that's to kind of introduce you to my paternal grandmother, who was from Grand Falls, Newfoundland, and who was a pretty amazing woman in my book. And I didn't really get to meet her until I was in my early 20s because our families, my dad was Navy, my uncle was Army, my aunts were Air Force, my grandfather on my father's side was RCMP, Royal Canadian Mounted Police. So the families were zip, 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 zip moving all the time. I didn't grow up with my family at all. So I didn't really get a chance to know my grandmother. I met her, I met her when I was a tyke, but I didn't get to know her. And when I met her, I was totally captivated by her. She was charming. She was witty. She was funny. She was really, really funny. She talked about things we did not talk about in our family. She talked about feelings. She talked about things that went wrong. She would talk about all kinds of things with an honesty and a compassion that was totally new to me. And that's what was so captivating. And, she also drank the world's worst tea and she chain smoked. And so I matched her smoke for smoke and horrible cup of tea for horrible cup of tea. I have not had a cup of tea since then. I was my tannic acid level for life. But, she chugged this tea and she smoked these cigarettes and I joined her and it was just brilliant. And, I didn't discover until later that, my grandmother actually had struggled with the disease of alcoholism for most of her life. In the 1920s in Halifax, Nova Scotia, she had four young kids. She had she had a fairly domineering husband with a very public job, a very public facing job. She would go on benders, and the solution then, right, was basically they'd send for her mother. Her mother would come and look after the kids while my grandmother dried out. And then the whole pattern would repeat itself over and over, because in the 1920s in Halifax, Nova Scotia, there was no solution. There was no solution to the disease of alcoholism. And so my grandmother actually tried to sober up through the Oxford groups of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she wasn't successful. But when I hear our history, it's really personal to me, because I can imagine my grandmother. I know what it was like when I came in at 94, and I felt a stigma, attached to being a woman and being a lush and being, a drunk and all those kinds of things. And I don't have any children, but my friends and my sponsees who are moms, just the mother guilt that comes along with that as well. And I can only imagine what it was like for my grandmother. But the thing is, like, when I met her, she had been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for 7 years. And so she was speaking the language of the heart to me. She was showing me the unconditional love that I found in the rooms of AA. She allowed me to see what it looked like so that I recognized it when I came in through the doors. And so while my heart breaks to think of the struggles that she faced in the 20s as an alcoholic woman in Halifax, Nova Scotia, I am so glad that there was Alcoholics Anonymous at the end of her life, because she died about a year after I met her. And that Alcoholics was there, Anonymous was there in my time. And I don't know why, and I don't need to know why. I just need to be really grateful for that. And I am. I really, really am. And you know, the other thing is, I, you know, when Gail asked if I would share with you today, it's very close to the anniversary of my father's death. My father died May 8th, 1994. And I sobered up February 19th, 1994. And, you know, my parents would come out to Vancouver every March. They would come out to break up the winters. They lived in Ontario, in small town, central Ontario, a little place called Midland, shores of Georgian Bay, gorgeous, beautiful in summer, sucked in the winter. But, you know, they were in Midland. And so they'd come out to Vancouver because I moved to Vancouver in the late 70s for a break. And in 1994, my mom came out without my dad. So my dad hadn't been feeling well. And what you need to know about my dad and me is that I adored my father. I just adored him. He was the visible alcoholic in our family. He was, you know, you could point that out. He was a very, you know, he was a happy alcoholic, right? He was a high functioning. He was once he, you know, he was restless, irritable, and discontent until he got the requisite amount of alcohol in his system at the precise time every day. And then, you know, and then he would start to mellow out, and then he would start to be, you know, a happy person, and things became real for him in a sense. And, you know, I spent a lot of time trying to get my dad's attention, right? Cause I just adored him so much. And I, you know, I finally got it after I had, like, you know, I'd run away with the town, like, anyway, I'd run away with the town dope dealer. I had finished high school in the city. I just, you know, I was a pretty wild child back then. And, but what that all meant was, you know, when I came of age, I could drink with my father. And my father was always really proud of the way I drank, because I could drink like a man. I could drink most men under the table. And he was just delighted with that, because he thought it would make me safe in the world. And I was delighted because when we were drinking together, my father would talk to me, right? And he could express emotion, and I could feel like we had a real relationship in it. You know, we don't regret the past, it says in our promises, but I look back a little wistfully and think, you know, we had a relationship based on booze. We had a relationship based on, you know, the unlocking for both of us of the, you know, of that part of ourselves that somehow had to be fed with alcohol. But, you know, nonetheless, it was, you know, it was what it was. So that March, when I sobered up in February, that March, my mom came out without my dad because he'd had a rough winter. And she said, mom said, you know, why don't you come back to Midland, like in late spring, early summer? And, you know, so I booked a flight for mid-May to go back and see my parents. And my mom called me the first week of May, like probably this day, and 32 years ago, and said, you need to come sooner. Your dad's in hospital. We don't know what's going on. And you just need to get home. I don't have any brothers or sisters. So, you know, for my mom to call me, and it was serious. And I knew it was serious, you know, and I had been sober just long enough, right? Just long enough. You know, I was going to as many meetings as I could, because I tried AA back in 91, and I just hated everything about it. But when I finally hit what I hope was my bottom and I came back, you know, I went to a ton of meetings, and I just tried to soak it all in. And, you know, I spent time trying to find a woman who would be my spouse. I just did it as differently as I could from my first time around. And so, because I had been sober just long enough, like, I asked people for help when I was going through this. I got the news. It was like I had to change a flight. I was sober just long enough that I could do that, because it got complicated. I asked you all, every meeting I went to, I asked you to pray for me and to pray for my dad. And you did. You absolutely did. Because I got on that plane, it was a red eye. And I got to tell you, I liked nothing better than to drink and fly. Right? That extra altitude just gave me that extra attitude. So I was the person at the bank, back of the plane, like smoking her face off and drinking her drinks off and, you know, just being the party animal. And so I was getting on a plane sober. And so I got on the plane, and I could feel my dad on one shoulder, and I could feel my higher power on the other shoulder. And I thought to myself, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay. And I didn't know what was going to await me. And I landed, a cousin picked me up at the airport, took me to my parents' house. My mom and I went to the hospital. And 20 minutes after I got there, I got to tell my dad I loved him. I got to tell my dad I'd look after my mom. And 20 minutes after I got there, he died. And I know he was waiting for me, right? He was not conscious per se. I know he was. I know he knew I was there. And so, you know, that was May 8th, 1994. And it was Mother's Day, actually, that day. And so, you know, my father's death was my gift of life. It was alcoholism that killed him. It was determined that it was pancreatic cancer due to chronic alcoholism. And you know, I never would have been able to have been there without you all helping me. So I take my sobriety very seriously, right? I take it joyfully, don't get me wrong, but I take it really seriously because so many of us have died. So many of us are dying. And for me to be given this incredible second chance at life and to be able to say to my father that I would look after my mother, right? And mean it and know that somehow I would do it because you were all going to teach me how to be the daughter that I needed to be, because I didn't know how. I really didn't. But you were going to teach me, and you did. You absolutely did. And it was remarkable to me. And, you know, with my father's passing as well, I've mentioned my grandmother, you know, and my dad had four siblings, right? He had, it was my dad. He had two sisters, the Air Force people, and then his younger brother, George. And George was the Army guy. And George was a member of AA. And in fact, it was George who had carried the message of AA to his mother, to my grandmother. And when my dad died, my Uncle George came bounding back into my life. There is no way to describe my Uncle George except as bounding, right? He's kind of like James. Hi, James. He's kind of like James. He bounces and is like Tigger. And he's like, you know, he's just like, hello, right? He's just this bright spark. And he carries a message like no other. And when, you know, if whatever base my Uncle George was on, there was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There was a coffee pot, a big book, and a room where there was a meeting of AA. And many times it was a meeting with just Uncle George and the big book and the coffee pot. And that was fine with him. He was a good old fashioned AA member. And he came literally bounding into my life. He lived in Ottawa. So he came to my parents' home after the day after my dad died, because my dad's death was pretty sudden, all things considered. And he gave me this great big AA hug, which I recognized because I'd gone to enough meetings to recognize an AA hug. And then he did that long timer thing, and he kind of pushed me back, right? He pushed me, held me by the shoulders and pushed me back. And he said, how long have you been sober now, Trish? Because he'd been following along. And I said, I don't know, you know, February 19th. And he said, you didn't drink today, did you? And I said, no. And he said, today was probably the worst day of your life, wasn't it? And he said, you lost your dad. And I said, yeah, yesterday. And I said, yeah, probably. And he said, and you didn't drink. I said, no, I didn't. And he said, well, you know, here's the news, Trish, like, you don't have to drink again. And no, one day at a time for Uncle George at this point, right? He was like all in. He said, you don't have to drink ever again. And I just kind of looked at him, and he said, but here's the thing. He said, you don't have to do it alone. And that was what melted the icy reserve, that tiny little part of my heart that had not thawed yet, had not totally embraced Alcoholics Anonymous and the members of Alcoholics Anonymous who were so willing to help me, because it came from my Uncle George. It came from this guy that I loved and adored. Like when we got together the few times as families, when we were posted close enough together, you know, he'd take me swimming wherever I wanted to go swimming. He'd take me to Dairy Queen for breakfast and tell me that I could have anything I wanted, but if I didn't eat the whole thing, I had to have another. And I believed him. You know, he took me back to my parents at one place, and he had someone in the back of the car. And I realized later that, you know, it was actually, he was working with a newcomer, and he was just like, I have to take my niece back to see her parents. Get in the car, right? Get in the car. My mother whispering to my father, you tell your brother not to put one of those people in the car with my daughter again, little knowing that that person in the back of the car was probably going to save my life, because I owe my sobriety to like thousands and thousands of people I will never meet, I will never know. And the work that people do in Alcoholics Anonymous to make recovery possible for people like me is beyond astonishing. Right. It just and I absolutely owe. And that's all part of it for me. You know, I promised. So Uncle George, right. And I was just like, yes. And I believed him. And so I was writing the script again, you know, like I had a tendency to do. And I thought, you know, I'm going to go back to Vancouver, kind of do some business stuff and come back to Ottawa. And Uncle George and I will go to all kinds of meetings and we'll beam around Ontario. And you know, it wasn't the way it was. My Uncle George passed away about a year after that. But I did meet every member of his home group, because every member of his home group was at his funeral. Right. And so were the Army brass. And so were all these people. And it was just, you know, it never happens the way I picture it. There's a power at work that's greater than me that has a plan that I know nothing about. And if it, you know, if as soon as I start writing the script, boy, it's like, oh, that's not the way it's going to work. It's just not the way it's going to work. But, you know, it was such a gift to have Uncle George back in my life at that point, to the point that I had him. And I know I've got about 5 minutes left, and I want to be really respectful of the time, because I can't wait to hear James. And I just, you know, I do want to acknowledge that, you know, one of the things that I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, because I've just been, obviously I get a little reflective this time of year, but I was thinking about my very first 12-step call. And we got the call. It was the old days, got a call from central office, you know, grabbed another home group member, off we went to see Mrs. J, another woman and I. And when we got there, it became evident that Mrs. J actually didn't really have a problem with alcohol. There was probably some dementia at work. There were maybe some mental health issues at work. So we checked in with the caretaker of the building to make sure that there were people checking in on her. And we made her some tea and, you know, nuked her her dinner. And we just chatted, and she was lovely. And then the thing was that while she didn't have a problem with alcohol, there were all these pictures of her husband on the mantle and all over the place. And she told us in great detail that her husband had been a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was so proud of him. And she knew that if you called AA, AA would come. And the enormous responsibility of that statement, that was not what I expected in my first 12-step call. But if you call AA, AA will come. That is what we belong to. That is the strength and power of this organization, that people in the midst of all kinds of crises know that if you call AA, AA will come. And it took my last, I had an incredible journey in service in Alcoholics Anonymous, for which I am so grateful. And, you know, I got to do some things that on your behalf, like, thank you, all of you. You know, I went to Bolivia as the trustee at large for Canada, for their convention, just right after COVID, when things opened up again, because I was trustee at large during COVID. So most of my time was trustee at small in little Zoom windows, which was fine. But I was in Bolivia. It was my last official international assignment as trustee at large. And Bolivia was going through some unrest, some civil unrest. And so it was dodgy and it was tricky. And they almost canceled the convention, but they didn't. And so we checked with the hotel and said, you know, we're going down to the general service office, which is downtown. When do you advise we leave? What should we do? And they said, you should be okay leaving, but make sure you come back before 2 o'clock, because you won't be able to get back into the hotel because of the barricades after 2 o'clock. So we went to the general service office of Bolivia, and their general service office manager is a man named Chiki. And he's a lovely man. And he came running out of the door. It was in a sort of fourplex apartment building. And he came running out of their door, and he had tears in his eyes. And he said, you came. And it took me right back to my first 12-step call. We came. You called AA for a neighborly 12-step call so that we could share experience, strength, and hope about what it's like for AA for us in the U.S. and Canada. And this man with tears in his eyes in Bolivia said you came. And again, that enormous responsibility that we have as sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the enormous responsibility we have to Alcoholics Anonymous as a direct result. It strikes me both on that very personal level and on that kind of global level. And, you know, I'm just so grateful that this, you know, selfish, horrible alcoholic with the most boring drunk story I've ever heard was given the grace of sobriety and given the incredible privilege of doing what I you know, of going places and doing things that I never, ever could have imagined. I actually thought my life was going to be beige and boring and bland in AA, and it has been anything but. And I'm so grateful. And Gail, thank you again so much for the opportunity to be at this wonderful open AA Grapevine meeting. And thank you all for being here. And James, I look forward to hearing you. Thank you.
Oh, Trish, thank you so much. You definitely wear your heart of AA on your sleeve, and I'm so grateful for that. Thank you. So just before I introduce our second speaker, there's a couple of announcements. The seventh tradition of AA states that every AA group should be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA members can help by contributing to your group, your local office, your area and district, and to the General Service Board. There's a great pamphlet called Self-Support, Where Money and Spirituality Mix. You can find it on AA.org. Grapevine does not accept direct contributions, but of course we do have expenses. The best way to support Grapevine is to subscribe to the magazine, either in print, online, or on the apps. You can subscribe to the magazine in print or online by visiting aagrapevine.org. You can subscribe to the app by searching for AA Grapevine on the App Store or on your phone. You can also purchase Grapevine books, greeting cards, and other items at your local AA office. By doing so, you'll be supporting both Grapevine and your local office. You can also visit the Grapevine online store at aagrapevine.org. The AA Grapevine Carry the Message products allows you to help us by helping others, by providing magazine subscriptions to those who are incarcerated, hospitalized, living in remote areas, or stuck at home. Visit aagrapevine.org and click on Carry the Message to learn more. We invite you to listen to our other weekly podcast, the AA Grapevine Half Hour Variety Hour. Which is available for free on all podcast platforms or on aagrapevine.org. Check out Our Primary Purpose, the official podcast of the General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous. Tune in to hear AA's message continues to reach those who need it most. For all podcasts, be sure to subscribe on your favorite streaming platform so you can catch all episodes. Please follow Grapevine on Instagram and YouTube as well. And now our second speaker. And James, I don't know you very well. I met you for the first time last October, but you strike me as a force to be reckoned with. And I'm grateful that you agreed to join us today and share just some of your story. So James, with no further ado, please take it away.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Hi, Trish. Very grateful to be here today, to be sober. I have to say that my sponsor is on this meeting. So when it says once in a while he may tell the truth, it looks like this is going to be one of those times. But I'm very thankful to be sober today and in this meeting. I'm James. My sobriety date is October 18th, 1994. I came into AA when I was 26, and I'm 58 now. When Trish was sharing, my dad also died 3 months after I came into AA. Lost my dad January 26, 1995. He was a member of AA. He had 22 years. He had 14 One person told me he had 17 years and drank. Another person told me he had 14 years and drank. But I do know that in 1973, he drank. And my mom and I and my sister went to California, where we had family living there. And I remember that there was talk of maybe we would be moving to California. Whereas I thought I was really going to, you know, Disneyland. I think what was happening is my mom was getting ready to, like, pull the plug on our family. But what happened was we ended up coming back to Buffalo, and I was able to be with my dad over the course of his time. I will say that I didn't realize for quite a while that alcohol, and in my case, drugs. For the record, I'm like a social cocaine smoker, so you know that's important. We recognize that. But I took my first drink when I was 13 years old, and I knew my dad was alcoholic, and I knew alcohol was bad. Told me that he was a skid row gutter bum. My dad, it's crazy. My father was born north of Toronto in Orillia. My father's family's all very Scottish and Canadian, very white. And my mom is first generation Italian. So when they were married in 54, that was like total interracial marriage. I never actually saw my grandmother speak to my mother ever in my life, but I don't know what that was about. But I think it had something to do with, you know, what I would call, we impose these things on ourselves, you know, these boundaries or these ideas, and then we hang on to them. And that can be for people who are alcoholic and non-alcoholic. And the one thing I've learned is that our design for living gives me the ability to be able to examine these, some what maybe are even new old ideas, you know, to see how is this serving me? And is it really about less of me and more of other people? You know, that's where this has to end up, is less of me, more of others, if we're going to be living what this thing sets out to show us. But that first drink, we were new to a neighborhood. I had no friends, and I was littler than everybody else in this neighborhood. There was a pool. It was kind of a private gated pool community. And this girl came up to me and at the pool and said, "You're Jimmy, right?" I'm not supposed to use my last name, sorry. So I was like, I couldn't talk. And she said, "I'm having a party at my house at 2 o'clock. Don't come before 2 o'clock. And, you know, I couldn't speak. So, but I did happen to say, "I know where you live," because I was their paper boy. But I was like, so I went to my home and my mother said, "Felix," what my whole family calls me Felix. That's my middle name after my mom's father, Felice. So she said, "What's going on?" I said, "I'm going to go to a party, Ma." And she said, "Oh, I'll make a tray of rigging." I said, "No, I'm not bringing any food, Mom. I'm going to go to this party." So, but if I would have on the way there known that there would be alcohol there or that I was going to drink, I would have not gone. Or, you know, if you would have forced me to go there to drink, I might have fought you. But I didn't know any of that was going to happen. I got the courage up to go to this party. I walked up to this house. Kids where I lived, you know, I was under this misapprehension that I lived in the slums of Ransom Oaks. There's no such thing as the slums of Ransom Oaks. But everybody's house that was bigger than ours seemed to be much bigger than ours. And doing the steps and learning that I grew up like ashamed of my parents because my parents were much older, not like anybody else's parents, didn't dress or act like anybody else's parents. And I had this sense of shame, not fitting in, not feeling like I knew how to be comfortable in my own skin. And that was before I ever picked up a drink. So this music is pounding out of the house. I knock on the door. No one answered. I open the door and go in. And I turn to the right in this pretty spacious living room. And there's all these kids from the back of the bus. I only would sit like three rows back or four rows back from the bus driver. I didn't know anybody. I was very timid, you know. You might not believe that now, but And I was a new kid. So these are the kids from the back of the bus, you know, and they're all a lot older than me. And they start saying, oh, Jimmy, my last name, Jimmy's here. Jimmy's here. And I'm like, wow, they know me. And this girl comes up to me, which was this girl's younger sister, and hands me a glass. And in that glass is clear liquid and a lime. And she said, here, drink this. And I drank that. And that turned out to be a vodka gimlet. And in that moment, everything went away. The idea that I don't fit in, the idea that I'm a new kid, the idea that my mom does not dress like these other kids' moms. You know, what I didn't realize was my mom was a senior dress buyer for the sample stores in Buffalo in the 50s. She went all the way through the whole phase of materialism, fat, and just was like herself. And my dad, not the kind of guy that would throw a football with you, but very okay in his own skin. And I would say, Dad, how come we never have a new car? And he would say, because I'm not stupid, son. And I didn't know what he meant by that. You know what I mean? He worked for the Department of Defense his entire life. Could be a very severe guy. And so we would get cars that were Ford LTDs or Plymouth Grand Furies or, you know, things that came out of the motor pool. You know, they were nothing like anybody else's parents. And all this, when that drink went down, that all went away. And, you know, I've heard my worst day sober is better than my best day drunk. That's not my experience. That was an amazing day. I'll tell you right now. I was 13 years old. A lot of things started to happen. And these kids were all like, you know, juniors, seniors in high school. And a very short while later, this girl was picking me up and taking me to school, you know, in her Camaro. And I was this cool kid. And I started to use drugs at a very young age as well. And it led me to, 3 DWIs, a lot of fighting, a lot of arrests, a lot of, you know, Trish, when you said how much you craved your father's attention, you know, we would do anything to get our father's attention. You know, I looked at that when I came into AA and I realized that because my dad traveled so extensively for the government, he wasn't home very much. And I was resentful of that, but I didn't know that. And I missed him. So my solution, not knowing this was happening subconsciously, was to get in some very, very severe jams. And so one of the ways that I got my father's attention was to try to transport drugs over the border from Canada to America. And so that's how. So that was an interesting moment where I got in the car with him after I told him what was going on. And he turned to me and said, you're in extreme physical danger right now. Don't say one word to me, not one word. So I just rode real quiet to the federal building downtown and, you know, got out, went up there. I met a woman and she was with the Commerce Department. She asked me some questions and she was looking at me like I was a piece of trash, you know? And I realized that I had embarrassed my father. I don't think he wasn't a guy that could be embarrassed, but I felt like I was in the wrong spot. You know what I mean? And he didn't say a word to me. A man came to get me out of another room, said, your father's waiting downstairs. I walked around, the locked in his car clicked. I got in. He drove me to where my car was, clicked the lock, and I got out. And I didn't talk to him for a couple of more weeks. I let him cool off, you know. But the idea is that once I got sober, I think what I would call divine symmetry and beauty of God's love is that he only gives us what we can handle in little eyedroppers. Because if I had seen what really alcohol and drugs had really cost me, I couldn't have lived with it. My dad, we weren't wealthy people, but he had dual citizenship. We had some racehorses. They would race at Woodbine, Greenwood, Fort Erie. And he would tell me, son, meet me across the river. We'll work. We had a little barn there. And they'd be at the backstretch when they were at that particular track. And he'd say, son, meet me over the river. We'll work out the horses and go to breakfast. I have no idea how many times my dad asked me to do that. But I can tell you how many times I met him. Zero times. Zero times. See, it takes everything from us. and we don't even know it. So the idea that then we can be given a design for living that helps us to reconcile all of this, to understand it, to be okay with it, and to love it, to say, okay, this is our story. And, you know, if you're new here, I don't know what who's on this meeting, but first of all, I love the Grapevine. I was Area 50 Grapevine chair for 2 years. Bill said AA's Grapevine's magic carpet, and fell in love with the Grapevine. And I was traveling for business in, you know, before they had these kind of Zoom things. And I would bring the Grapevine with me to various states where I was working in the golf business. And one time I was in Latrobe, Pennsylvania at Arnold Palmer's Country Club. And they were drinking Arnold Palmer's with vodka with Arnold Palmer. And I went back to this little bungalow where I was staying, took out my Grapevine, read a couple of stories, got on my knees, went back to the party. I didn't want to drink that day, but I just felt like this is, I just need to, and that's why I had a meeting. That was probably 2000. That was not probably, it was exactly 2005 that that happened. So Grapevine's always been a part of my life. Wherever I go, it's always in the suitcase still to this day. But so I don't know who's on this meeting, and thank God we're all here. But if you're new, what has to happen is at some point is it doesn't matter what I think about being an alcoholic, because the literature taught me the illness centers in my mind, right? So, and it doesn't matter how I feel about it, because my emotions change like the weather. And not because I'm alcoholic. I'm not one of these people, oh, my alcoholism, this, that. No. My emotions change like the weather because I'm a human being. So it doesn't matter, you know, what I think about it or how I feel about it. What's important is, what am I going to do about it? What am I going to do about all of this? So that's where the steps come in. And I've been blessed, you know, to not drink a day at a time or do any drugs. I had a couple doctors try to put me on pills along the way. I don't have a position on, you know, antidepressants. If you take them, fine. I'm not a doctor. I don't prescribe or unprescribe. My experience is that I split up with these guys I was partners with. Very exclusive restaurant, making a lot of money. They lost a hotel after September 11th. It was a very traumatic time. And my sister was in medicine. She's the brains of the family. She's 10 years older than me. And she had this guy call me and say, you know, I understand you're going through. My mom had died. This is 2000. My mom died February 3rd, 2004. By now I was in this new job and brand new job. And I had split up in this other thing, and it was a really difficult time. So this psychiatrist who knew my sister calls me up, nice guy, he's been to our house, whatever. And he tells me, you know, this and this. He said, I want you to come into the office. We can sit, talk. He said, you know, Don, my sister seems to think maybe you need a mood stabilizer. I just flipped out on him. I was like, I just told you my mother died in my arms. I split up with my partner making 140K a year. And you tell me you got a pill to solve this. I said, I need 10,000, Ken. Can I borrow 10,000 for 6 months? And he didn't answer. And he goes, hello. I said, hello. And he goes, I don't know. I said, yeah, I thought so. So I hung up. And then I went into this little office where I was, got on my knees, said a prayer. I was crying. Got up, went downstairs into the lower level of this country club, looked myself in the mirror, washed my face, and went to work. Ended up, you know, having a pretty good career there. But so I'm saying this because my experience is that I lost my dad. I lost some careers. You know, things change. I lost my mom. I was divorced in 2008, February 7, 2008. I was 12 step. I was 13 step by a woman in AA. That's my story. Nah, but he's got a little more time than me. But the truth is, I made a decision based on self, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. Now, what's fascinating about the quantum nature of Alcoholics Anonymous is that if I make a decision, let's say on a beach, in 1996 to start talking to this girl that's in AA. Somehow she gets pregnant and we have a couple kids and we're together for about 11 years. That decision based on self on that beach, that placed me in a position to be hurt 11 and a half years later. In my mind, it was 11 and a half years and in my experience, but really in God's time, it was right then. Everything was set into motion in that predatory, manipulative, selfish, self-centered, lustful interaction that I had on that beach, all based on self, all placed me in a position to be hurt. So there's a lot of learning that takes place here. Some of it's very costly. And so I was divorced, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous also. There was another time, another doctor friend of my sister tried to put me on pills. I was living in her son's bedroom. So he was in Arizona getting his doctorate. And I was living in their house after all this unfolded started to. And thank God, you know, my ex-wife has 33 years of sobriety. She has not drank. She's been a great mother to our children. We are cordial with each other. And this is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we both had tools to not make it any worse. Thank God. You know, so things happen. Then my second wife died of cancer. I'm not like trying to start a ton of organ music, but that did happen. That was horrible. Yeah. And she was not alcoholic. It was a very difficult situation. So I'm saying this because, you know, life is going to happen. I've never liked that phrase, life on life's terms. To me, life on God's terms seems somehow less severe or less disconnected, you know. Now you'd say, so God gave your wife stage 4 pancreatic cancer? No, our culture did that. Our, you know, her eating Prilosec, you know, and drinking coffee, and she was an occasional cigarette smoker, very, very rarely, but, you know, and things happen, you know, our culture, our things create cancer. God has nothing to do with cancer, first of all. But so I'm saying this because, you know, I have to understand that our design for living can orient me into a place to where I'm dependent upon God in a love affair, that I don't need to make sense of any of this. I think mental institutions are packed full of people that have to know why. I'm out of why. I just know, what am I going to do to broaden and deepen my conscious contact with my higher power? That's my only question. And if I get really quiet, you know, that's where self-examination, meditation, and prayer is so important. Chuck's on this call. Chuck saved my life. I would be dead. Probably saved my ex-wife's life. Ashamed to say that. I mean, I was in a bad spot. And he's the one that turned on the lights in Area 50. I told him I had some resentments. Roswell, you know, Amy's aunt, who they were really close friends. She encouraged us to go to Roswell because she was a director of nurse anesthesiology there. And I had this all written out on a legal pad. I met Chuck. Told him the first resentment, which was Mary. He said, hold on, they're the glamour girls, right? They're these. He looked at me and he said, because he was, of course, at our wedding, he said, so Mary encourages her best friend, who's also her niece, to go to Roswell where she works. The treatment protocol is not coherent. The paperwork is not right. She starts to decline. You have to go to somewhere else. And she ends up passing away. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. And Chuck looks at me with those eyes and said, have you prayed for Mary yet? Have you prayed for her? Can you imagine what she must be going through? And I was like, And he said, I'm not here to talk about this. I'm here to talk about Area 50. Area 50 is dark, and you're going to be the next general service representative. He said, you're going to be the next GSR of the High Noon Group. Now I was in AA 20 years at that time. Imagine that, 20 years. He said, you're going to be the next GSR of the High Noon Group. And I said, what's a GSR? I had no idea what that was. He said, General Service Representative, you're going to go there. I said, do we have to vote? He goes, nah, no one's going to know what it is. You're going to be the GSR. Start coming to the General Service Assemblies. Instrumental in getting our area, him and a bunch of other people involved. That's how I got to be GSR. Then I was DCM. Guys in Canada told me DCM stands for don't call me. That was real. And then I became Grapevine chair, corrections chair. I was in a jail meeting this morning. That was pretty cool. It's a good meeting. Some guys are getting sober there, which is grace of God. Yeah, that's a miracle. And that's where grapevines come in so handy, stacks of grapevines. So my third wife is Molly. I wonder if she might. Molly, if you're on here, hi, baby. I love you. She is the Class A non-alcoholic trustee of Alcoholics Anonymous, because my first sponsor, John, told me, wherever you are, you get the P.O. Box 459 to your house. That's what he would do, just like that. And so I'm like, that was 1995. He never said read them, okay? I don't really, but Molly read it. You know, yeah, Molly read it. But when I would get it, right, when all this was happening, subpoena, shut off notice, legal bill, collection agency, summons, P.O. Box 459. Okay, I'm an AA. It's a 459. I know where Riverside Drive is and the Grapevine. So it was with me. Then we got a house together, and Molly read it. And she said, they're looking for Class A non-alcoholic trustees. You think I should apply? I'm like, yeah, go ahead. Never even thought of it for another 3 months. And then Molly told me, you know, that board is still vetting me. They're asking for credentials. And, you know, there's quite a vetting process, and there's some communication. And I said, Mom, what are we talking about? Because I forgot that she told me that. And also, she's on other boards. So she's like, AA? I said, wow. So then it got to like 24 to like 12 to 8 to, I think, to 6 to 4. And then I prayed. And now she's on the board. And this is a miracle. And we were friends since 2009. So Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, is the fabric of my life, has been constructed by this design for living, which is based in, you know, when Chuck and I, when I first went to his office, we sat down and he put a box of Kleenex between us. And I'm like, wow, that's why, sure enough, like, you know, a few minutes later, I was sobbing. And so after all this, you know, time, I took a lot of what time? All right, what, I got five, like a couple minutes? No, shut up. So I'm in his office, and so I tell him, he's a lawyer. I mean, a real lawyer, right? So they charge big money. So I'm like, so people like me stream in and out of your office every day, and you just, when do you work? When do you make money? He looks at me with this insane look, and he goes, James, it's the power. It's the power, James. And I'm like, wow, this guy's weird. You know, I was 13 years without a drink, and I was not surrendered. You see what I mean? I didn't understand that this power actually could flow through us, provide more than we could ever dream of, create a life that my diseased brain can never imagine. But Chuck was living in the middle of it then. And so, but it was time to get out of his office, and because he had other guys waiting. I'm like, oh, my God. So I go to his we're walking out toward the door, and he goes, hey, can I show you something? And he turned to page, I think, 89 in the 12 and 12. And he pointed out a paragraph that says, there is a direct linkage among self-examination, meditation, and prayer. Taken separately, these can provide much relief and benefit. But when they are logically related and interwoven, the result is an unshakable foundation for life. And at that moment, at 13 years without a drink, for the first time ever, I felt and thought, all right, I will do anything. And self-examination, meditation, prayer, participation in general service, and that's how it goes. So this is my story. Thank God I'm sober. Thank God we're all here. Trish, I'm sorry I couldn't get to Vancouver. It wasn't in the cards. It just wasn't. I have a small business I'm involved in, and sometimes it just was going to be too much of a headache. And but you know, to, plus that was Molly's time. But the one thing I do know, which I'll shut up after this, is that, you know, these old timers, there was Polish Richard when I first got here. And he would say, I'm the alcoholic. I'm the problem. The problem is me. I wake up in the morning. I go to bed at night. The only one in between there is me. I am the alcoholic. I'm the problem. And I would hear this and I think, this guy's been here 30 years and he's still the problem. That's sad. See, couldn't hear. And then happy Bernie. That's how I'm happy Bernie, happy alcoholic. Always happy. Really bothered me, you know? And he would point at me and say, you have a great day now, unless you make other plans. And I'd be like, but these men, they knew. They understood. It is a beautiful day unless they make other plans. And so the self-examination, the meditation, and the prayer are designed for living, ensure that it's not my plan, it's God's plan. And in that place, we relax and take it easy. We don't struggle. Fourth dimension stuff, you know. So that's enough out of me. Love you all. Thank God for AA.
James, thank you so much. I know our paths are going to cross again. And thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you, Trish, for being here. Absolutely. Yeah. No mistakes. Absolutely never a mistake. So please let your friends know about our meeting. This is an open meeting, so it is also ideal for friends who want to learn more about Alcoholics Anonymous. Keep this in mind when doing cooperation with the professional community or public information work. And I would like to now invite Trish to close our meeting with prayer of her choice.
Thanks very much, Gail and James. Thank you so much for your story. Thank you all for being here. And please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you all, and see you on the road of happy destiny.